from the new Benny Golson Art Farmer Jazz Tet album. That was Vass Simeon, and my guest is jazz composer, arranger, and tenor saxophonist Benny Golson, who has returned to his hometown, Philadelphia, for a concert tonight at the Afro-American Museum, and he'll be performing with the rhythm section that we just heard, the rhythm section from the Jazz Tet. The new album that we just heard is called Back to the City, and it features the Jazz Tet, which is a variation on the group that Golson organized with trumpeter Art Farmer in 1959. Philadelphia Inquirer jazz critic Francis Davis called the Jazz Tet one of the subtlest units of its era. When the group reunited in 1983, about 20 years after it broke up, Davis wrote how refreshing the Farmer-Golson combination still sounds. He said, "Writers as purposeful and inspired as Golson remain at a premium." Jazz listeners are delighted to have Benny Golson back and were afraid they had lost him to the more commercially rewarding work he was doing on the West Coast for movies, TV, and advertising. Mission Impossible, MASH, Room 22, and The Mod Squad are some of the TV shows that he wrote for. Before studio work lured him away from the jazz scene, Golson had played with bands led by Dizzy Gillespie, Tad Dameron, and Art Blakey, to name a few. With Blakey's Jazz Messengers, he was able to really show off his gifts as a composer. His compositions like Blues March, Along Came Betty, I Remember Clifford, and Whisper Not have become standards. His first real break as a composer came when Miles Davis and John Coltrane, at their first recording session together, included Golson's Stablemates. Coltrane and Golson knew each other from their Philadelphia days, when they were also good friends with bassist Percy Heath and used to jam at each other's houses. If you'd like to hear Benny Golson perform tonight, there are sets at 8 and 10 o'clock at the Afro-American Museum at 7th and Art Streets in Philadelphia. And for more information, you can call the museum at 574-0380. Benny Golson, welcome back to Philadelphia and welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Terry.
Is this much of a homecoming for you? Do you have many friends or family left in the city?
I have an army of friends and relatives here.
Really?
I do. I'll tell you, it's been such a facial change here, structurally, that I would hardly know where I was if I didn't know where I got off the train.
You came of age in Philadelphia and knew Percy Heath and John Coltrane when, I guess, you were still in high school.
Yes.
Did you rehearse or practice together a lot?
Constantly. John and I particularly. I met John when I was in high school. He'd just gotten out of the Navy. I think he was around 18, and I think I was around 16, and we were together every day. Now, Percy was in the Air Force, and so he got out a little later, but Jimmy, his brother, was active, and we used to always find some place to jam. That's what it was all about, down in Jimmy's living room or my living room or Johnny Cole's house. Or wherever, at any time.
Your parents let you play there? They didn't mind the noise?
Well, we started to wear the rug out, and then what she did was she bought an old kind of throwaway piano, sawed the legs off to get it down in the basement, and my father built a little room down in the basement so we could really kick up a lot of dust and noise.
Did you think you were all really good? Did you expect that you'd become the people you became?
Well, I don't know about the others, but myself, I never was sure. But I didn't dwell on that, you know, because I think when you're aspiring, you're always looking ahead and you don't think where you are quite as much as where you'd like to be. So that's a perpetual thing even to this day. I don't think any of us are really 100% satisfied. You reach this goal and you've yet seen another one, you know.
You started on piano, and I think it wasn't until you were 12 or something that you picked up the saxophone. Were you tired of the piano?
No. I used to hear piano. Well, both my uncles played piano. We all lived in the same house. It was a big three-story house. And I used to marvel how they could sit down and just play and sing these things. And I'd go sit down and it was nothing, you know, I couldn't do anything. And so my mother said, would you like to take piano lessons? I said, yes. But I took them with the provision that if I would consider playing the organ in the church, you know. So I said, okay, well, and I like the organ in church. And so for about... 9 to 14, about 3 years or so, that was okay. Somewhere along the line, I even fancied that I wanted to be a concert pianist. Until I went to the Earl Theater, which is now gone, I guess, 11th and Market, and heard a band, Lionel Hampton, and they played a song called Flying Home. And a fellow came out with tenor sax, glittering with all the lights shining on it, you know. And he played this solo. Piano was gone. I wanted to play saxophone. That was Arnett Cobb.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was that your introduction to jazz?
Not totally, but from the point of the tenor saxophone. That just, I was hypnotized. I was in a trance as I heard him play. It just did things to me emotionally inside, you know, when I heard him play. And I didn't get a saxophone right away. So I would go home and listen to, I can't think of the name of that program going that time. It was on at night. And before going to sleep, I would turn it on and wait for all the tenor saxophone solos to come up and whatever tunes they were playing, you know. And that's what I did day after day after day. I used to listen to, during the war years, Glenn Miller used to come on every night, I think at 7:15 for 15 minutes, Camel Caravan, something like that. And I used to listen to Tex Beneke. Anybody that played tenor saxophone, you know, I just, oh, man. So my mother saw I was really serious. This thing wasn't going to go away. And much to my surprise, she came home with a tenor saxophone one day, you know, not really understanding what the tenor saxophone was all about. She just happened to pick out a very nice one. And boy, I was on my way.
Was that the end of the church organ music?
That sort of died away quietly. No one said anything about that anymore.
When did you start to compose and arrange? Did you have anybody to arrange for?
No. Strange how that came about. I used to fancy myself playing like Coleman Hawkins or Don Byas or Dexter Gordon, who came a little later. And I couldn't always remember the solos. So I started trying to write the solos down in my own fashion. Of course, no one could play it but me. And once I learned to do that the proper way, I started to wonder how would it sound if other people were playing something. So I had to find something to write for them. So I just started to try, and some of it was pretty bad, you know. But little by little, it started to come along. I remember we had a rehearsal down in my basement once, and the bass player was Percy Heath. And I had written this thing, I can't remember. It's called A Maharaj in the Blues, that's right. I don't know why I remember that. And he had such a strange look on his face. And when we got halfway through, he said, you haven't written a tonic for me yet. And bass is supposed to play the tonics, the roots, you know, he's the anchor. I hadn't written a root for him at all. It was just sort of wandering around, you know. But it's things like that, you know, you learn trial and error. But I'm still trying to, it's not exactly what I want, you know, we're never satisfied. That song you just played was, it's a new direction I'm going into right now. It doesn't mean I've forsaken the others, but rather than give up what I've done, I'll just add to it, you know. One doesn't have to give up something to add something to what he's doing, just sort of enlarge what you're doing. You know?
My guest is jazz tenor saxophonist, composer, and arranger Benny Golson. And he's in Philadelphia to perform tonight at the Afro-American Museum with sets at 8 and 10 o'clock. You are, I think, one of the few musicians of your generation, jazz musicians of your generation, who went to college. And you went to Howard University, but only stayed for about 2.5 years.
Two and a half years.
Were you majoring in music?
Well, they were quickly preparing me to become a music teacher, I guess.
Did you want to do that?
In the school system. Not really, but I wanted to learn more about the academics, I guess, of music. And, of course, to do that, you had to get the peripheral things, you know, the psychology and the public speaking and whatever, you know, Qual Wasser, tests and measurements, things that I'll never use, you know. So after a couple of years, we used to get homework, of course, and this was into the third year. And I'm hearing certain things in my head, but they're contrary to all the rules. You can't, the fifth must go to the tonic, and this must go here, and you must not have fifths, and no parallel motion. So I knew that I was harmonizing the assignment wrong, but I was harmonizing it the way I heard it and felt it. And so I took it to class to see what was going to happen. And she had a way of reviewing what you had done in front of the class. And when she got to mine, the red pencil was just slashing away at the paper, you know. And she stopped and said, Mr. Golson, what have you done? And I indignantly said, well, that's the way I heard it. And I think within the week I packed up and just left.
I take it that she wasn't a jazz teacher and this wasn't
course. No, no, no. And I couldn't play my saxophone. I had to enter on clarinet. And I had to, of course, keep up with the piano for 2 years anyway because I had already played. I had to play my saxophone in the evenings in the laundry room in the basement downstairs, see. You know, it was so rigid. It's not like it is today. And I said, well, heck, what am I doing here, you know? Maybe I don't want to be a school teacher. And there's nothing wrong with being a school teacher, but it just wasn't what was in my heart. So I left with the idea of probably going up to Boston or New England Conservatory after taking a little break or something. But the break is still going on. I never got back.
Why didn't you go back? Did you find out that you really liked the musician's
working.
Life?
I started working, you know. And as things would have it, I started working with the rhythm and blues groups, you know. No one knew of me as a jazz saxophonist.
What kind of rhythm and blues groups?
Well, the first group I went out with was a group called Bull Moose Jackson and His Buffalo Bearcats, which was back in 1951, I guess. And after I joined the group, and he saw that I could read pretty good, my musicianship was pretty good, he asked me, did I know of any other fellows from Philadelphia that, you know, might like to play in. So I recommended Johnny Coles, who's an excellent musician, and he wanted more. I recommended Jimmy Merritt, and he did a drummer. I recommended Philly Joe Jones. Now, as it turns out, the piano player in that band was one of my idols at that time, Tad Dameron. And so we had a really great band. We would play the things that he sang, and then we'd do the jazz thing. So,
my guest is Benny Golson, if you're just joining us, and he's going to be performing this evening at 8 and 10 at the Afro-American Museum. So you got your start as a musician on the road with rhythm and blues bands. Now, that gives great opportunities to a tenor saxophonist because there's a lot of great moves that you can make in R&B bands. Did you lay on your back and play or...
No.
Do anything fancy like that?
No, I didn't lay on my back. But every now and then, I'd have to walk the bar. You know, you get up on top of the bar and you'd fleet of feet, you'd step over the drinks, you know. Oh, yes. I saw my good friend John Coltrane doing that once up at, right in Philadelphia, up at 23rd Ridge Avenue. It was a place called the Ridge Point. And I'd heard he was working up there. And I'd said, now, wait a minute. Everybody that works there on tenor saxophone has to work, you know, walk the bar. So I said, I think I'll go up there Saturday, the matinee, and see what's happening. And as I opened the door, which was right at the point, like the slice of pie, right at the tip, he was making the turn to go back in the other direction, and he looked and saw me, looked right into my face, and he stopped playing. He said, oh, no. And I was just dying laughing, and he continued down the other way. And years later, he recalled that, yeah.
Why should he say, oh, no, is it embarrassing to be doing that?
Because... we fancied that we were jazz players. And, well, to keep body and soul together, sometimes you had to do these rhythm and blues things. But it was nothing that we bragged about. And he'd come back home locally in the midst of all of his peers, the jazz musicians, as it were, and then one of them walk in and see him doing that, you know. It was like a come down, like a bring down. Of course, I understood.
You played with Tad Dameron for a while, and he was a great composer and arranger. Did
yes.
you learn much about composing and arranging from being with him?
Not all from him. You know, like most creative people, I guess I was eclectic. You pick up a little here, a little there. Intuitively, you remember these things sometimes, you know. But I must say that Tad was completely open. He shared everything he knew with me, quite openly.
You had initially intended to become a teacher, and here you were, living the jazz life, being on the road in jazz bands and sometimes with rhythm and blues bands. Did you like that life?
Terry, I loved it. It was my first time out, you know, traveling from city to city. Oh, boy, I thought this was it. But like all things, you get used to it. And then after a while, you say, oh, boy, another trip, you know. You go to Europe, first time, it's fantastic. And the second time, you say, oh, yes, I remember that. And the third time, you say, oh, yes, we've been here before. The fourth time, oh, yeah. Fifth time, sixth time, oh, boy, okay. You know, but it's okay. It's what you make of it, I guess, you know. But wherever you go, if you can do what you like doing it in the way that you like doing it, you know, it sort of makes up for it all.
You played with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers.
High point in my life.
What made it the high point?
Art Blakey. I'd never played with a drummer like that in my life. And when I left that band, it was hard for me to play with another drummer. He's so right in every way as a jazz drummer. You know, I spoke to Freddie Hubbard about that once, and he said, you too? He says, I had the same problem when I left. I would turn around, look at the drummers, you know. I was expecting what I'd been hearing.
I had heard that you had suggested to Blakey that he basically get a new set of musicians. Is that true?
Yes, I'll tell you how that came about. I would have never done it. What a presumptuous statement. But, you know, I'd admired him for so long. Like when I was in college, I used to buy his records. And I heard the things that he would do. The introduction on Straight No Chaser, if anybody has a chance, just go back and review that. He's doing four different things at the same time, two hands and two feet, which you call an independence. And one night, early in my arrival in New York City, he called me and asked me could I come in to fill in for Jackie McLean one night. He was sick or something like that. And I jumped at the opportunity. I would have paid him, you know. And so I went down to Cafe Bohemia, and we played, and it seemed like the illness went on a little while, so he asked me would I finish the week. And, of course, I was delighted. And but I noticed, you know, he wasn't working a lot, and certainly the money wasn't commensurate with his talent. And so we were talking next door to the other place, you know, in the intermission to go have a beer, something like that. And I said, Art, you know, you should be making a lot more money than this. And he says, yes, I know it. He says, do you know what I should do? I said, yes, I do know. So he looked at me. I always said, he looked at me with those pretty sad, sad cow eyes, and he said, can you help me? And so I said, yes. And then the next thing that came out of my mouth, I don't believe I said it. I said, yes, if you do exactly what I tell you to do. Can you believe it? I didn't know what I was doing myself. But he did. He said, well, what shall I do? And it was hard to say this, but I said it to him because I knew the fellows. I said, you have to get a new band. He said, really? For this reason, that reason. And he says, okay. He says, well, who should we get? I said, well, there's a trumpet player that I used to work with Dizzy Gillespie. He's young, but he's good. His name is Lee Morgan. I said, there's a piano player, also from Philadelphia. Seems like I always go to Philly, right? Bobby Timmons, piano. Jimmy Merritt again on bass. He says, you think they play? I said, I'll talk to them. And so they did. And to this day, I can't understand why those other guys didn't have hard feelings with me, because they knew that I was behind it. And I'm not going to mention any names either. But we got the new band. And so I told him this and I told him that. And I said, you have to do this, you have to do that. I said, there are certain clubs that they feel maybe they don't want you back because you're a little tardy, you know, an hour late showing up. And I said, we have to make sure that we're on time. And I used to go by and pick him up to make sure he was on time. I said, before they hear us play a note, they're going to see us. So we have to look right, you know, when we step out on the stage. I said, we must have a concert. By this time, I was talking with the booking agent too, in Shaw, Jack Whittemore. I said, we need a concert at Town Hall. I said, we're going to wear tux. We're going to get back in this particular club that didn't want us in. I say, we'll know that we are on the right track if they ask for us back. These people had said they didn't want the Jazz Musicians back ever. And the day came not too long, they wanted us back.
What made you so image conscious and so confident about what the band needed to do to make a go of it commercially?
Actually, Art had the talent. You know, no matter who plays with Art, till this day, he works and he's in demand. And we were really just attaching ourselves to him. That's what we were doing without his knowing it. And without knowing it, Art was and is a didactic person musically. He's a natural teacher. You know, and I learned a lot from him. Everybody goes in that band and comes out a little more wealthy musically.
Well, why don't we listen to a recording that you made with Art Blakey? And I think that this is basically the band that you just described with some of the Philadelphia musicians.
That's the band, exactly.
Jimmy Merritt on bass and Lee Morgan on trumpet.
That's it, exactly.
Bobby Timmons, piano. You were on tenor saxophone. We're going to hear your composition, Along Came Betty. You want to say anything about the piece?
I wrote this tune and some other tunes for that particular band. That's another thing I told him. I said, you need some new material. He was playing the same things over and over again. I didn't know that mine was going to be great or anything, but at least new material. And I guess the cheapest way was for me to do it than to hire somebody else to do it. We didn't have any money. And Blues March I wrote for him, for example. Along Came Betty, yeah. That was one of the first ones we did.
Let's listen to it. This is Along Came Betty, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. My guest, Benny Golson on tenor saxophone. Benny Golson's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Afro-American Museum. Thank you. It's Along Came Betty featuring Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers with my guest Benny Golson on tenor saxophone, and that was his composition. And composer, arranger, and musician Benny Golson is in Philadelphia, which is his hometown, to play this evening at the Afro-American Museum with sets at 8 and 10 o'clock. Did playing with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers help establish you more as a composer?
Yes, it certainly did. You mentioned Miles Davis. That was the send-off, and the other things that happened were an adjunct to that. They were cumulative, you know. And people would ask me, do you have any tunes? Well, when I was traveling with the rhythm and blues bands, I guess it was a shotgun approach. You know, you're young and maybe you're even, can't think of the right word there. You push a little too aggressive sometimes. And I would have my tunes and I would just leave these, it's like somebody throwing them out from an airplane over a city. And a lot of people started recording. I guess they had the tunes, and then after other people started recording, then they started to do them too. And things just accumulated, you know. And then they would call and ask for tunes, and they would ask me to write tunes especially for them and things like that.
I guess that's the best thing, when people commission you to write for them.
Yeah.
When you and Art Farmer organized your own group together, the Jazz Tet, did you put into practice some of the principles that you were trying to convince Art Blakey to follow, you know, like... playing a place like Town Hall and, you know, dressing up for first performances and things like that so you could, I don't know, get a certain reputation for that.
I don't remember how that happened, but it always had to be a mutual decision. If either one of us decided that we didn't want to do something, we wouldn't do it. In order to do something, we both had to be in agreement. So I guess we must have had similar minds, similar thinking, you know. We had the uniforms when we first started off.
What were they?
Suits.
Suits, uh-huh.
As we did with Art Blakey. And we tried to work some of the better places, you know, because all places weren't always so nice, you know. Dives, if you will, you know. We tried to work the better places, and it turned out, for as long as we lasted, it was pretty good.
When you have your own bands, it's a business, and you have to...
Yeah.
Bring some business savvy to it. How did you feel about having that responsibility in addition to all the musical responsibility?
It was an added burden to be a businessman, quote unquote, but it was necessary. And in order to carry out what we wanted to do musically, we had to have a certain modicum of business savvy, as you say. And that got better too as we went along. Of course, we had a manager. She believed in us so much that she never took any commission the whole time we were in existence. Isn't that incredible?
Sure is.
Yeah, it's incredible.
When you and Art Farmer broke up the Jazz Tet, which you had together for 3 or 4 years, and you broke it up in around 63 or something.
Right.
You basically left jazz for a while.
No.
Nothing?
We didn't leave jazz, but we decided that we wanted to do other things, that we had been together long enough. And the way I was writing then, it was very organized. It sounded okay, I guess, but it was very organized. Just before we did break up, we started to get a little looser, as we are now, hopefully. But I began to do things. I started playing singles, traveling around the country and playing with local rhythm sections. That had its own frustrations too, you know, rhythm sections and their rhythm sections, and sometimes the abilities weren't so, you know, and you had to fight with that during the whole week. And Art did similar things. He got a trio with Jim Hall and Steve Swallow, I think, for a while. It was a trio, I think it was, yes. And he did some other things too. As a matter of fact, he had a quartet for a while with Jimmy Heath from here. He did a few things, and then he traveled around and did some singles too. And he used to go to Europe, and that's how he wound up moving over there. He found out he was spending more time over there because the opportunities to play and make some money were more over there than here.
At some point, I guess it was in the 60s, you started dropping out of performing jazz and started doing more studio work and working for advertising companies, and eventually you moved to the West Coast and did TV work and film work. Why did you drift away from performing and from writing for other jazz groups to do the more studio-oriented work?
Well, Terry, I've always had two loves, musically, of course. It's like having two wives, playing and writing. they were never equiparable, parallel to each other. One was always a little more than the other. And if I changed it, then, of course, it would shift. I'd write more. And then if I'd dwell on the other side, then I'd play more. I just decided that I would like to really learn how to write in a way that I hadn't been writing before. And so there was a fellow that was teaching at Bennington College who used to orchestrate for Alex North in Hollywood. He did Cleopatra, Spartacus, Kings Go Forth, and things like that, and he was excellent. And it turned out that he only had two students. It was me and a fellow named Tom McIntosh in New York. And I would go over to his house every Sunday morning and for an hour and study with him. And I think I had three sessions with him. And I went to do a picture in Germany. And I was so glad I'd been. Just the three sessions, 3 hours. You can't imagine how it helped me. And when I came back, I continued to study with him. And then I felt, well, maybe I'm ready to go out to Hollywood, because Quincy Jones had been saying to me, we were friends, you should come on out. And Leonard Feather, the jazz critic, moved out, and he was calling from time to time, said, you should really come out here. You know, now's the time. And then Oliver Nelson went out, and he was saying the same thing. So finally I decided I would go out. But I went out very carefully. I left my family in New York, and I went out and got a little place, you know, a little cubbyhole, and it seemed like it was going to be all right. And then we moved out, and I got a call from Alex North. He said, Brandt, yeah, Henry Brandt won't be able to come out and orchestrate this thing, he says, and he told me that you were one of his students and you were out here. Can you do it? He says, I need some period music. And I said, okay. He was out at the Samuel Golden Studios, and it wasn't orchestrating the film, but what period music is, Terry, is it's just what it is, really, from whatever period. It's the 17th century, something that sounds like George Shearing, a gavotte, whatever. And I could do that, so I did some period music for that film. You know, you never saw my name on it, but they paid me, and that was all right because I was trying to get in out there. And at that time, Quincy Jones, like I said, was my good friend. He was his agent was Peter Faith, who was Percy Faith's son. They're both deceased now. And he says, well, look, I'll talk to Peter and see what so-and-so. Okay. And so Peter said, yes, okay. And, boy, within a couple of weeks, he says, look, got something for you out at Universal. So I went out there, and the man's also deceased now, Stanley Wilson. He said, we've got a new series here with Robert Wagner called It Takes a Thief. He said, you want to? And Dave Grusin had done the theme. That's right. But he wouldn't be able to do the episodes. He was busy doing other things. He said, do you want to try one? I said, yeah, I'll try one. And I did that. He said, you want another one? I said, yeah, I'll try another one. And then one thing led to another. Then I got a call out at 20th Century with Lionel Newman was out there. What was a new series going on then called Room 222. And then I got a call out at Green Gems. It's a Partridge Family. Then Paramount, Mission Impossible was going in, and Mannix. You know, one thing just led to another. And then you do some movies of the weeks and things like that, and some pilots. And that kept me going. And this is what I wanted to do. But, you know, the reason I put the saxophone down during that time, when I first went out there, people were saying in the movie industry, oh, Benny Golson, what does he do? But the jazz people were saying, are you free? We'd like you for an engagement such and such a time. So I said, yeah, I've got to offset this. So I wouldn't take any jazz gigs because I would be like a bebopper, you know. And
That would be bad?
Yeah, I wanted to be viewed as a composer. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even take a job as an orchestrator, except for that period music that I did for Alex North. I got a job to orchestrate was Gordon Park's first film. And the money was very nice, Terry. And I turned it down. And I called my other, my friend Tom McIntosh, and he came out and he did it because he had, you know, he was going to do the pitch and go back home. But if I did it, I figure I'd be branded as an orchestrator, only orchestrating other people's ideas. And I'm a composer, and I wanted to be recognized as a composer, so I turned it down. Anyway.
Did that strategy work?
Yes, it did. It did. My wife thought I was absolutely crazy because my little nest egg was going down like an elevator out of control. But it worked out. It finally did, and they got to know who I was, and then it was okay, you know.
Were you chosen especially for jazz-oriented scores?
See, and that's what I didn't want, because when I started on It Takes a Thief, it had like a little hip finger-popping kind of walking bass line and things. And I said, yeah, this is not really what I want to do. And eventually I was able to get in some other things, even at that studio, Universal, and the other studios too.
You know, I'm thinking back in the days of Mission Impossible that spy and detective series still used jazz then, whereas, you know, cop shows, for the most part now, and detective and spy shows tend to use more funk-oriented music now.
Oh, yeah.
With the exception of a couple of shows. Hill Street Blues is a more, quote, jazz-oriented.
Yeah.
And Spencer for Hire, jazz-oriented score.
Right.
But did you miss that, or did you not much care when jazz started leaving the world of TV themes?
Well, I got in, Terry, just before everything became synthesized and jazz and funk and whatever. But the days of the Franz Waxmans, what was the one that was a big one out there? My mind's gone. Alfred Newman's, that's gone right now. When a person says, I'm a film composer, it doesn't mean what it meant 20 or 25 years ago. But I got in on a part of that before it, so it's finished. Yeah.
So when you got to Los Angeles, you stopped playing partially because you didn't want your image to be
I stopped.
So that means that you didn't play. Did you play at home?
I didn't take it out of the case for about 7 or 8 years.
All or nothing at all?
Right. And when they stopped calling me, when the club owners up and down the coast stopped calling me, I said, I guess it's official now. I'm washed up. It's a sizable old player. They call and call, and then I'd always say, no, that's it. No. But by that time, I was established in the writing. And I did it. I did the writing for about 8 years or so, I guess. And then, wouldn't you know it, I got the itch again after all that time. And I started to pick the horn up again because there's a group back in New York wanted me to come and do a concert. And it took me weeks and weeks to get in shape, I thought. I wasn't really in shape. It took me about 8 years to get in shape because by the time I went back to it, I was wondering to myself, did I ever play this thing? You know, it felt like a piece of plumbing. My lips embouchure was like overripe tomatoes. The mind had cobwebs in it. It was mass confusion, frustration. Oh, I'll tell you, it was terrible. It was like getting over a stroke.
Mm.
And just last couple of years, I started to really feel comfortable. That's incredible.
Do you feel like your playing changed?
Oh, you know, I'll tell you. Oh, yes, it changed. Because before I actually stopped playing, Terry, I didn't like what I was playing. Have you ever gone to hear somebody and you say, oh, I don't like the way he sounds? That's the way I was. And it was me that I didn't like, you know, and that was pretty frustrating. So by the time I stopped, I wasn't feeling too good about what I was doing anyway. But the mind, it's capacious, you know. I would hear so many things and I would be playing mentally, you know. I'd hear a group playing, and, you know, and you start feeling emotional inside and then you're playing mentally. And when I picked the horn up again, the way I was playing when I stopped was gone. And something else was there. Not what I really desired, but it was a starting point, I felt. And I was able to modify from time to time. I tried this, I tried that. And I don't know if I'll ever really be satisfied. But I'm more satisfied now than I was before.
Are you sorry that you put it down for those 8 years?
Yes. When I was trying to come back, I said trying because it was a struggle. I should have never stopped. You know, I fell behind something awful. You know, the other guys, my peers, were going straight ahead, you know. So anyway, for what it's worth, here I am.
So at that point, when you started to play again and you were still composing for movies and TV and things like that?
Yes, I was still doing that too.
Did it affect your image at all?
Oh, no, I was
still concerned
then.
About that? Didn't matter.
I was established then, yeah.
When you were doing that kind of work, composing for movies and TV and ads and stuff, did you get a lot of lectures for people about, you know, keeping in mind what the mass audience wants? And did you have to stay in touch with musical trends so that you could write in the manner of whatever was the popular music of the day?
No, I had complete freedom. I tell you, just for the heck of it once, I was doing a score. I can't remember what it was. And I said, I think I'll take part of the melody to Stablemates. And I'll use it in here. It was a slow, dramatic kind of thing. And harmonize it another way, you know, abstract. And I did. And it was one person in the orchestra that recognized it. That was Tom Scott, you know, who does pretty good in that saxophone player. And when we finished, he started laughing. And nobody knew what he was laughing about except he and I.
I'm thinking about how funny it is, in a way, that you tried to almost disguise the fact that you were a jazz musician when there's so many studio musicians who would just give their right arm to be a good jazz musician. You know, like a lot of the people who play like that would love to, I think, really be good jazz musicians.
Well, I didn't really disguise it, but I played it down
right.
A bit, yeah. I didn't bring it to the front.
Why did you give up the film and ad and TV writing to go back into jazz?
My time was not my own. I became a slave. That's a paradox, you know. I left the jazz to go to it, something I wanted to do, and it was all right for a while. And the money was good, you know. It wasn't about money in the end. I didn't have the kind of freedom that I wanted, you know. So you give up. You have to give up something somewhere along the line. I have to sacrifice something. The family would be going to the beach, Malibu Beach. I'd walk them to the front door and wave goodbye and go back into the dungeon and work. You grind it out. And boy, they never gave you much. They never gave you much time. And I thank them, though. Universal Studios, they were the biggest shop out there, you know. They taught me how to write fast. Oliver Nelson was fast. And so you'd have 4 days sometimes. It turned out the music for the whole show, an hour show. The norm is 5 minutes of music a day. And sometimes it would be 30 minutes of music. And sometimes they would, over the weekend, after the studio is closed more or less, after I'd worked all day on a cue that's 5 minutes long, they changed it. So you can't use that music. None of the sync points will match. You got to do it all over again. It used to drive me crazy.
Well, did you mind that you wouldn't get credit for it too frequently?
No, I got credit for all that.
Because sometimes it doesn't seem to say who wrote all the
music. I always got credit.
You always got credit?
Sometimes I even went more. They gave me more.
Was there a last straw for you where you said, okay, this is it. Now I can't stand it anymore. I am leaving this.
Rather than a last straw, it was a cumulative, you know. It was a gradual this and that over a period of time. And I just got tired, and I said, I don't believe that I'm getting tired of this. And I was Oliver Nelson had just died, and they brought me in, and I guess they were considering me taking the show. And I was working on this episode of $6 Million Man, and it was so hard, because he was my friend too, maybe that had something to do with it, to finish this episode. I just didn't want to do it. It was drudgery, and I'm right in the middle of it, so you can't not do it. I said to my wife, I said, I think this is it. This is my last show. I can't do anymore. You know, I'm tired back to back, you know. And that was my last show. Since then, I got called once to do, was pretty nice, a 4-hour miniseries for NBC called, a few years ago, called Sophisticated Gents. And I think that was the last thing that I did. I enjoyed doing that.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do when you gave that up and re-entered jazz?
I knew I wanted to compose. I'm composing more now than when I first started, Terry. I'm writing lots and lots of things now, more than at the beginning. And I stopped arranging for other bands. I don't arrange for other bands now. I just don't have the feeling. Only thing I do now is do things for the Jazz Tet. And I figure that that's my outlet for the moment. I'm not saying I won't, but by choice, I've just decided to dedicate myself to this because it's what I want to do.
Did you approach Art Farmer about reuniting?
Yes, but not on my own initiative. What happened? I got a call from Europe from an entrepreneur, and he suggested that I get in touch with J.J. Johnson, and perhaps we could come over there and do some concerts. Well, J.J. had come out after me, and he was getting into things too, you know, and he didn't want to leave because one thing we all found out about Hollywood, they're extremely disloyal. So if you're out of town, they're going to call somebody else, and you come back, you have to get to the end of the line, you know. If you're not available, you have to be on call at all times, you know, which is a drag too. And he didn't want to leave. So I called the fella back, and I told him, well, no, no, J.J. couldn't do it. So then he said to me, well, do you have anything in mind? And I said, well, I've been doing some things with the quartet. And off the top of my head, for some strange reason, I don't know why, I said, unless we could put the Jazz Tet back just for some concerts. And he said, fantastic. And I said to myself, really? And so he said, okay, we'll set it up. And I'll tell you, the inscrutable Japanese people, somehow they found out about it. And don't you know, we went to Japan and did a tour with the Jazz Tet before we went to Europe. It's incredible. And recordings and whatnot. And so we decided, well, let's do this thing from time to time. It won't be an ongoing thing, but we'll do it when we like, you know. And so we would get together a couple of times a year, then three times a year, then four times a year. And we don't work constantly by our own choice. Art does some things on his own. I think he has with the quintet, and I'll do some things with the quartet, or I'll stay home and I'll compose. But we do come together from time to time, more with more frequency now than we did when we first got back together in 83.
Has all the time that you spent writing for movies and TV affected your composing at all? Do you think that you're writing in a different idiom at all?
That's interesting. I'd have to think about that. Maybe intuitively it did. But I'll tell you what, I know what did affect my writing, and it didn't affect it right away, jazz-wise, was the fellow that I told you I was studying with, Henry Brandt. He would, I don't know if this is sort of technical, but he made extensive use of symmetrical chords, pandiatonic writing, mirror writing, two different things going on at the same time. I'm trying to think of what that. Anyway, I decided, well, I wonder, can we use some of these things in jazz? And so I started dabbling in it. And the song of Vasimian, it's a composition. It has no chord structure. Not at all. It's just bass lines moving around, you know, and some things. When we start to blow solos, then that's a structure that has nothing to do with the other part, you know. It's almost arbitrary.
Earlier in our conversation, you said that when you first entered the jazz life, you were just so excited about it. It was so wonderful to be on the road and touring and playing, and then it became ordinary and maybe even tiresome. And now you're back. Certainly, you're not on the road as much as you were when you were young, but you're back performing again, which you hadn't done for a long time. How does it feel?
Effervescent. Yeah, I'm bubbling inside. Yeah, we all feel that way. We enjoy it. What a blessing it is to do what you enjoy and get paid for it.
That's great. And
it's
great to be able to come back to something, to leave it when you're ready to leave and to come back when you want to come back.
Yeah. And Art and I have been doing it for a while. And if we want to do it, we do it. If we don't want to do it, we don't do it. You know, it's not like those early days, you know, where you're trying to do everything, establish yourself and competitive. And
so you're really taking advantage of the security that you were able to build up with your career in the West Coast. And now you can really control what you want to do.
More or less, yeah.
That's great. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for
talking
with us.
Thanks for having me.
Today, it's really been great.
I hope I haven't been too effusive.
Oh, no, you're terrific.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with composer, arranger, and jazz tenor saxophonist Benny Golson, who, by the way, grew up in Philadelphia, and he's returned here for a concert this evening at the Afro-American Museum with sets at 8 and 10 o'clock, and the museum's on 7th and Art Streets. And I even have a phone number if you'd like to call for more information about that. And that phone number is 574-0380. That's 574-0380. And as you heard, Benny Golson and Art Farmer have reformed their group, the Jazz Tet. And Benny Golson is going to play this evening with the rhythm section of the Jazz Tet, Mickey Tucker, Ray Drummond, and Marvin Smitty Smith. And the Jazz Tet has a new album also. The album is called Back to the City, and it's just been released on the Fantasy record label. And let's get in another selection from this album. Why don't we hear Back to the City, another one of your compositions. Want to say anything about it?
I guess the title sort of speaks for itself. Art lives in Vienna, Austria. I live in Los Angeles. Curtis Fuller, we're all part of the initial group. He lives up near Boston somewhere. and the other fellows living here and there. And when we do come back together, the only place we play in New York City is Sweet Basil's now. We have an exclusive contract with them, and we're always glad to get back there, back to the city.
Well, let's hear it. Back to the City, Benny Golson with the Benny Golson Art Farmer Jazz Tet. Benny Golson soloing on his composition Back to the City from the new Jazz Tet album of the same name, Back to the City. And again, Benny Golson performs this evening at the Afro-American Museum on 7th and Art Streets. 3.5 minutes to 5 is the time. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. All Things Considered is coming up in just 3 minutes from National Public Radio. I'll tell you about what's happening next week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
On the Schuylkill eastbound, there's about a 30-minute delay between the Blue Route and City Avenue. Westbound, 30 minutes, Montgomery to Belmont. North on 95, a minor delay at the Ben Franklin Bridge. An accident in Philadelphia on Broad at South Penn Square. They're traveling on Vine Street. That's jammed from 22nd all the way up to the area of the Ben Franklin Bridge. Go to New Jersey via the Walt Whitman Bridge. Right now, there's only a minor delay approaching the Whitman tolls. Eastbound is open. Westbound is where that construction closure is. If you're traveling 42 southbound, a little slow between 130 and 295. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Philadelphia Electric. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be writer Maya Angelou. Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock, Danny Miller will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Mike Peters. And then at 4 o'clock, I'll speak with Phil Donahue, who's got a new evening TV show called The Human Animal, which begins Monday evening. So hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Paul Kerber was our engineer today. Assistance today from Abby Klebanoff. Also, assistance from Marty Moss Cohen. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. I'm about to go on a 2-week vacation. Danny Miller will be filling in as your host while I'm gone. I wish you a very good couple of weeks. Thanks for listening. My name's Terry Gross. Stay tuned for All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts invites you to visit this summer. Located at the corner of Broad and Cherry Streets in Philadelphia, the Academy is the home of an exciting collection spanning 3 centuries of American art. The collection features outstanding works by Charles Wilson Peale, Thomas Aikens, George O'Keefe, and Frank Stella. This summer, the Academy is the only East Coast stop for the critically acclaimed retrospective Franz Kline, The Vital Gesture. Robert Hughes, Time Magazine's art critic, characterized this show as distinguished and commanding. Come and see for yourself why New York Times critic Michael Brenson called Kline's images the richest in all of abstract painting. Franz Kline, The Vital Gesture, at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, now through September 28th. The Academy is open late until 7 p.m. every Wednesday. For further information, call 215-972-7600. You're listening to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
Shark real good. It was 17 feet long and a little over 10 foot around in girth.
It was a great white shark, more than 3,000 pounds, caught yesterday by rod and reel. The story of the one that did not get away, told by the fishermen tonight in All Things Considered.
Also, another car bombing in West Beirut.
President Reagan to the hospital tomorrow for a urinary examination.
On Capitol Hill, the House votes an amendment on the defense bill that would limit U.S. nuclear testing.
The centennial anniversary of the first ascent of Mont Blanc.
Flying in to Oshkosh, Wisconsin with experimental and home-built aircraft.
Also, a report from Maine on the last of the Shakers.
That and more coming up tonight on All Things Considered, but first this news.
This is Mark Boardman. President Reagan will undergo a urological examination tomorrow at Bethesda Naval Hospital. The White House made that announcement today, saying the tests are unrelated to his cancer of the colon, which required surgery last year. Officials say the exam is considered routine and that the president is feeling fine. In a strong arms control measure, the House today approved a temporary ban on nuclear weapons testing. The vote was 234 to 155. The House also trimmed $6 billion out of its overall defense bill, amounting to $292 billion. Meanwhile, the Senate today voted not to extend a ban on tests of anti-satellite weapons. The vote was 55 to 43 to kill the existing ban on tests of anti-satellite weapons, which was imposed by Congress last year. The Senate vote was part of its work on a $295 billion defense appropriations bill. NPR's Linda Wertheimer reports from Capitol Hill.
The Senate has spent the week slogging through a massive defense bill, which, in addition to the controversies it contains, has become the battleground for a partisan struggle over when the Senate will vote on sanctions against South Africa and on aid to anti-government forces in Nicaragua. In the course of a week's debate,